That experience has filled me with humility, I have to say. And it is something that's very subjective. It's extremely difficult to explain. I'm trying to get into the details, the granular details of how I got there in a book, but that is a short, the shortest story that I can tell.
Let's go to Richard Dawkins' reaction, because
that's a moving personal story, but to call yourself a Christian is a bit different. I mean, a Christian has to believe in something, and you go to church now, and you listen to the vicar, and do you kind of notice what a lot of nonsense he talks? I mean, do you really take it seriously that Jesus is the Son of God, Jesus rose from the dead, Jesus was born of a virgin, and that's part of Christianity?
So I think because you, and I know you very well, we've been friends for a long time, and in fact, in some ways, I think of you as a mentor. I would say you're coming at this from a place of there is nothing. And what has happened to me is I think I have accepted there is something. And when you accept that there is something, there is a powerful entity. For me, the God that turned me around, I think what the vicar is saying no longer sounds nonsensical. It makes a great deal of sense. And not only does it make a great deal of sense, it's also layered with the wisdom of millennia. And so, like you, I did mock faith in general, and probably Christianity in particular, but I don't do that anymore. And again, that is where the humility comes into it, is it doesn't seem, in 2024, after I went through that experience, it doesn't seem nonsensical to me, and I don't mock it. I think I've come down to my knees to say, perhaps those people who've always had faith have something that we who lost faith don't have.
So that was Iron Hershey Alley. She was, for a decade, the most famous female atheist in the world. She grew up in Somalia as a Muslim, and she always had questions about the faith of her childhood. And then as a teenager, she was going to be forced into an arranged marriage. And so her and her family fled to Europe, where she felt free to ask a lot more questions and ultimately deconverted from Islam and became a militant atheist. She wrote a blistering critique of all religion called Infidel. And for over a decade, she toured with Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and the other new atheist on college campuses and late night talk shows. But last year, what she was referring to, she had a mental health collapse with a lot of depression and anxiety. And she started noticing that a lot of her friends were encouraging her to consider faith again. And so she did. And she shocked the world last year by coming out and saying, "I am no longer an atheist. I am now a Christian." And that was her with her mentor, Richard Dawkins. And I wanted to open up with this story because something is happening right now in the world. For the last, 60, 70 years, it was just assumed that the long march of progress was going to be that eventually we would get rid of these old silly, childish beliefs in God and things like that. But as, to quote one Jewish agnostic, if there is no God, then why do we miss him so much? And I am seeing right now in church, in this church and in churches across the country and even world, people are coming to faith again, over and over again. And if that's you, maybe you're like some of the stories that I've heard in the last few months. People are like experiencing God. Sometimes they're even having dreams of the Lord. If that's you and you're here this morning, we are so glad you're here. And I'd love to talk with you. There is this Catholic writer named G.K. Chesterton who 100 years ago was noticing Christianity's decline in England. And he talked about how in different times in church history, like the fall of Rome or the Islamic conquest, it seemed, this is what he said, it seemed like there were times that faith went to the dogs. There have been times when the faith has all, by all appearances, gone to the dogs, but it was the dog that died. Christianity has died many times and risen again, for it had a God who knew its way out of the grave. And if that's you, if you sense God is doing something in your life, I'm so encouraged. I'm so glad you're here. Maybe you've heard that phrase, invite Jesus into your life, but that's not quite true. Because come on, our lives are a dumpster fire. Jesus is not trying to get into your life. He's trying to get us into his life. I have a preacher buddy, Chris Seidman, who has a friend who has two kids that were 5 and 3 years old. And the 5-year-old brother was reading to his 3-year-old sister. And at one point, he was reading a part of the story that was just not real. And so he said, he stopped and said to her, "Now we know, you know, this is not possible." And the 3-year-old sister screamed back, "You're not the boss of possible." If there's anything the story of Easter reminds us of, it's that. Now, if you're skeptical about this and you're just here because it's kind of a cultural holiday, I get it. I'm glad you're here. But you do need to know, you're not the first people to be skeptical about this. In fact, the first century Israelites would have been among the most it would consider it the most implausible. Because here's the thing about growing up in the faith of Judaism. The biggest thing you are taught is that there is only one God, and humans do not get worship. Only God. God is the only one worthy of worship. And yet we have historical examples within a couple of years of resurrection of these Jewish men and women worshiping Jesus as God. Not just that, they started worshiping on Sunday. When were Jews worship? What day did Jews worship? Saturday. Thousands of people started worshiping on a Sunday instead of Saturday. Now, I don't know if you know religious people. We don't do change. And all of a sudden, this secular historians are like baffled by this. This is a real thing. Like, what happened on this day? In other words, there are really good historical evidence that this actually happened. And nobody saw it coming. Despite Jesus saying over and over again two things. One, I'm going to be killed. And two, I am not going to stay dead. Outside of a handful of men and women whose hearts were broken on that first Easter Sunday, everybody had forgotten about Jesus. And yet here we all are. So if you have your Bibles, turn with me to the Gospel of John, starting in verse 1 in chapter 20. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciples, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." So Peter and the other disciples started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter. This is actually John talking about himself, which I love. This is the first Easter, and male ego still is male ego. Like, look, everything changed. It was crazy. It was happening, and I beat Peter. I just want you to know I beat him. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went inside. He saw and believed, and they still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had risen from the dead. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. I think this is the only story in the Bible where everybody's running in the story. I mean, can you feel the chaos? They don't know if this is good news or bad news or what kind of news. They just know it's bizarre. They know this is really strange. They don't have a game plan for this. And all throughout the Gospel of John, this has been written a few decades after the resurrection. He's the latest gospel to be written. And he's looking back on it, trying to make sense of what does it mean that God raised Jesus from the dead. And so he's been telling this story for 20 chapters. He starts off his gospel with the words, in the beginning. He tells about seven different miracles or signs that Jesus does. Can you see what he's doing? He's showing us in Jesus' life is a new creation. You get a fresh start, a new way of doing it again. You get to turn the chapter and start over. By the way, next Sunday, we are having Baptism Sunday here. So that's why we're doing baptism class on Wednesday night. If you're looking at starting over, if you know you need something in your life, we'll have that class on Wednesday night, but also next Sunday is Baptism Sunday, where people are going to be giving their life to the Lord. And if you're interested in that, that's happening this week. So everyone in this story is surprised, running around. They're terrified. They're hopeful, but they're also just been burned. I mean, their hearts are broken. And so they don't want to hope too much. They're skeptical. And that leads us to this part in verse 11. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look in the tomb and saw two angels dressed in white, seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. And they said, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they've put him." And at this, she turned away and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. He asked, "Woman, why are you crying? What are you looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you've put him and I will get him." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and cried out to him in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. Instead, go to my brothers and sisters and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and now your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with this news, "I have seen the Lord," and she told them that he had said these things to her. You know why Mary is the first there? It's because she was possessed by seven demons, and Jesus had set her free. Her devotion is directly tied to her liberation. And you notice she thought he was the gardener. You see what's happening here? Mary is right at the same time that she's wrong. Because Jesus, this even if you don't have words for it, have you ever noticed that you know something is missing in your life and in the world? That is this ache every human being has for the Garden of Eden. Even if we don't know what it is. And Jesus is on the scene giving us a fresh chance. Mary comes as a mourner. She leaves as a messenger. And every person who has met the risen Jesus has the same mission. It is to announce that death no longer gets the last word. We don't have to remain in bondage to status quo. That nothing we are doing, nothing we are going through, the resurrection cannot cure. And Easter has put behind any reason to be afraid of death. Jesus leaves his grave clothes behind. That's how you were buried in the ancient world. You were buried wrapped in linens, and he takes them off and leaves them behind because he no longer has any need of anything to do with death. But that's not to say his followers felt that way, because the very next time we see them, they're hiding behind locked doors. And the reason they're hiding behind locked doors is because they saw what the Jewish leaders had done to their leader. They didn't want that to happen to them. And so they're terrified. They're still afraid. They're confused by, what does this mean that Jesus raised from the dead? Did he raise from the dead? What does this mean? So they're locked. They're in their most secure place. And I can't imagine how much joy it gave Jesus to do this. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus ignores the locked doors, just comes through and stands among them, and his first words aren't, ta-da! His first words are, peace. This is the thing you're hungry for. It's what the whole world is hungry for. Not the kind of peace we fight for today, the kind that can be won with wars and violence, or not the kind of peace that comes from avoiding conflict, but the peace that comes from knowing that death has been defeated. And then he goes on, as peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you. And with that, he breathed on them and said, receive the Holy Spirit. He gives them his presence. Do you see what's happening in the resurrection story? So, last couple chapters, Jesus has been arrested. He's in a courtroom. He's being tried by the Sanhedrin, the Jewish leaders, and Pilate in Rome. And they have sentenced him to death. The resurrection is heaven as the Supreme Court overturning the verdict. And he is giving them this life, this kind of resurrection life when he breathes on them. It's a shock. It's an insult to our worldview, and not just modern ones, because even though we like to imagine it, we are not the first people in history to notice dead people stay dead. But to believe in this story is to have your heart torn open. It is to have hope. It's about living in a way you never dreamed possible. It's that God raised Jesus from the dead, and anything's possible. Everyone's welcome. And all can be remade and reborn. But not everyone gets this. Specifically, one person who wasn't there. Thomas, one of Jesus' disciples. Now, Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my fingers where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Watch this. Stop doubting and believe." And Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus said, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed," and this is Jesus' blessing for you, "blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." One of the things I love about this story is that Thomas is still with him. Jesus in the Gospel of John is very stark. You're either in or you're out. He's the way, the truth, and the life. He is light, and the world is darkness. Jesus, just a couple of chapters earlier, he was washing the disciples' feet, and Peter said, "I don't want to have anything to do. You'll never wash my feet." And he said, "If I don't wash your feet, you will not have anything to do with me." In other words, this is the way, Peter. But now when Thomas doesn't believe the most basic truth about Christianity, that God raised Jesus from the dead, they don't kick him out. He's still with them. Their faith, kind of what Jeff said at communion, their faith, he was leaning on their faith until this moment happened. The Gospel of John says, Jesus, to all who believe, gives us power. It is resurrection power of God. And this is what the power of God looks like, by the way. But John says, to all who believe, he will give us the power to be born again, the power to become children. You're not the boss of possible. Do you know why I'm so cynical? Why you're so cynical? It's because we one time had our heart broken. We had hoped, and we got burned. And so we thought to ourselves, never again. That's why there's so much jadedness in the world. And we tell ourselves, when we're watching that movie and our heart swells, or we're listening to that beautiful song, or we're at a good meal with good friends and family, and our heart starts to swell, we tell ourselves there are no happy endings, and we defend ourselves from joy. But what if cynicism isn't just bad for you? It's wrong. What if every hope, the tug of hope you felt, isn't trying to fool you, but to open your eyes? C.S. Lewis, the great Christian thinker 60 years ago, described Resurrection Sunday this way. He said, the thing about, if you could put that quote up, something perfectly new in the history of the universe had happened in the resurrection. Christ had defeated death. The door that had always been locked had for the very first time been forced open. Something new had appeared in the universe, as new as the first appearing of organic life. That is the story. What are we going to make of it? In other words, in the resurrection, something new happened in the world. The door of the universe had been forced open. And yet, Thomas shows us there are some doors that God will not unlock. The door of the human heart opens from the inside by God's sovereignty. So what are you going to do with this story? And don't fool ourselves. The reason it's hard to believe isn't because we believe in science now or whatever. That's the kind of modern secular myth. We kind of evolved and we put away those childish things like dragons and fairies. It's for a different reason. There's a philosopher named Charles Taylor who wrote a like 800-page book called A Secular Age, all about why it's hard for modern people to believe in things like today. And that's the whole point of the book, 800 pages just to answer that question. And he says, you know, most of us tell ourselves that story of, like, I used to believe that when I was a kid, but now I've grown up and I believe in these other things. And he said, no, that's not really what's happening. What's happening is, unlike our ancestors 500 years ago, they had a lot more modesty about their own opinions and ideas. And so when it, like, for example, suffering, that's a thing that causes a lot of people to question God. So, and by the way, 500 years ago, our ancestors suffered a lot more than most of us. But they didn't do it that way, because what's happened over the last 500 years is this assumption has crept in that if there was a good reason that God had for making the world the way it is, the brokenness, the suffering in the world, if God had a good reason, I should be able to think of it with my mind. And because I can't, there must not be any God. Have you ever been there before? I want y'all to hear a testimony from my friend Zach Otwell. I've known Zach for a long time. I love this guy. Zach is a lot like us. He's a lot like Thomas. And so I want you to hear his story.
A few years ago, I sat in this very room on Easter Sunday in the church I had grown up in, surrounded by family, by mentors, by close friends, in the place that shaped so much of who I was. And I did not believe a word that was said. I did not sing, I did not bow my head to pray. I thought it was all a lie, a story we told ourselves to feel better in the face of death, or even a way to coerce others to think the same way that we did. Honestly, I was only there because I knew it would upset my family if I wasn't. My doubt had begun months earlier when I picked up a book by Christopher Hitchens called God Is Not Great. And this was followed by reading Dawkins, Sam Harris, and they were persuasive. They made it seem as though faith in God were childish, a fairy tale, something that I believed in only to avoid the fact that I lived alone in a universe without a God. It was just wish fulfillment. What made their arguments so powerful, though, were the fact that they pointed out fears that I already had, fears that I had been too afraid to ask even myself because I was afraid of the answers, that maybe I only believed in God so that I could feel better. It was a comforting story that I had inherited to avoid facing a meaningless world, and that they didn't just question And this didn't just question my faith, it made me feel foolish for having ever believed in the first place. So I decided in this moment that if God was real, then he could withstand my questions. And if he wasn't, I did not want to believe in him. I wanted the truth with or without God. And what followed was one of the hardest parts of my life. Every belief that I have unraveled, my morality, my Christian ethics, close relationships, my belief in the existence of God. The people closest to me said, Zach, I don't even know who you are anymore. I became convinced that God was in fact not real, and that to believe in God, in the Christian faith, would be intellectually dishonest. And this was not a quick journey, not one that lasted a few days or a few weeks or even a few months, but years. It was years of studying, of questions, of conversations, but eventually it was revealed to me that despite my best attempts to remove my bias, My view of the world was one that only allowed for physical explanations of things. And this was not a neutral lens. For most of human history, belief in God or gods was assumed. It was not until the last few hundred years that we came to start viewing the world as a machine, that if we could find a physical explanation for something, there need not be a spiritual one. I inherited a way of seeing that made it difficult to believe. But the more I thought through this, the more I realized the most important things in my life were more than physical. They couldn't be measured. They couldn't be quantified. Love, suffering, hope. Yes, there are chemical reactions and evolutionary theories behind all of them, but that doesn't tell the whole story. And this thought cracked the door open for me. Maybe faith was not the opposite of reason or rationality. Maybe it was a way of seeing that includes reason, but also reached beyond it. As I continued this journey, there were countless people, scientists, philosophers, and scholars who believed not in spite of their intellect, but because of it. I also started showing up again, not with any kind of faith, not with any kind of belief, but just with curiosity and openness. I joined an alpha group to ask these questions within a community. I began to serve, and I began to listen for God. And honestly, I heard a lot of silence, but I kept at it. And little by little, I began to uncover a faith that was not afraid to explore difficult questions. This was not a blind leap, but a growing trust, not a denial of reason, but a deeper kind of understanding. I realized I didn't have to sacrifice my intellect to believe in God. If anything, my faith now feels more whole because it makes space for both doubt and the mystery. So on a day where Christians celebrate something that to many seems unbelievable, I just want to say I get it. I resonate with that feeling. I've been there. But I've also learned that you don't have to abandon your rationality to believe this. And you don't have to push down your questions for our God. He allows us to wrestle with him. And I encourage you to do the same.
I'm so proud of what God has done in Zach's life. You ever changed your mind? Maybe about something really big? Or seen something one way and then realized, oh, I misread it. Like, maybe you've seen these kind of pictures online. This is not a dog trapped in the Wizard of Oz world. Or what about this SUV is not floating? Or this woman is not marrying Hedwig from Harry Potter? Or this is not a rare sighting of a fire-breathing golden retriever? You know, so much of our struggle with faith, it might be time to relook at some assumptions. Because we don't know much about him. We know he was a historical character from Israel around the first century. He probably grew up poor. He probably married, as was pretty customary, had kids, but at some point, because of the high rate of Roman taxes, like almost 50%, because of just being in poverty, he chose to go to a life of crime. Originally stealing, but then aggressively more, like so much so that he was branded a terrorist by Rome. And when they finally captured him, Rome did what they did so well. They stripped you naked, they stretched out your arms just like Jesus, and they crucified him. And on the day he was crucified with two others, and one of them was this very popular rabbi. He knew it was him because there was a sign above his head. And this man, this thief on the cross, noticed that there was more of a crowd mocking than normal because of that man in the middle. And after a while, even though he's in excruciating pain, and even though the thing that is the hardest of being crucified is you can't breathe, every breath hurts, eventually he started mocking the man in the middle too. And I don't know exactly what he said, but I'm pretty sure I know why he said it. I've asked it myself. I've seen it asked in hospital rooms and funeral homes and jail cells and pastors' offices. It's some version of why. When there's a gap in your life, when there's a gap between your hopes and dreams and what you got, and when it gets big enough, there's this part in all of us that wants to shake our fist at heaven, but he can't even do that. So with all the pain it cost him, he still joins in mocking. Why God? And the great irony of this day is if at any point the thief on the cross would have said, "Where are you, God?" The answer would have been 10 feet to your left. Have you, because of life, confused life with God? Have you drawn conclusions about God and faith based on prayers that weren't answered or on your experiences? There are times in everyone's life where we go through something we can't make sense of. There are times in everyone's life where belief in God seems impossible or a million miles away. Don't let our pride fool us. We are not the masters of the universe we think we are. And those moments where God feels so distant might be the moment where he's breathing right next to you. You know what I love about Thomas? He's so sure, he's so certain, everything. He's protected. He protects himself. I'm not going to believe unless I touch, unless I... And then Jesus shows up and he drops all those conditions. He immediately says, "My Lord and my God." The strongest statement in the whole gospel about Jesus. Not, okay, you win, but yes. Do you realize what happened in Thomas's life? He realized God really is that good. He really can't hope too much. He realized, and this is what I want you to realize, that what the resurrection means is that what God did for Jesus, he's going to do for every one of us. There will be a day when everything is set right, when God will, when justice rolls down like river and righteousness like a never-ending stream, there will be a day where there is no more sorrow or pain or death, for the old order of things has passed away. And most of all, on that day, we will be with Jesus himself. And in the words of our Lord Jesus, stop doubting. And believe.